everybody, welcome back to Burger Bounce, a podcast by Steak and Honour. It's the final episode of Series 1. I want to thank everybody who's listened so far. I really, really, really appreciate it. On the final episode, we've got a friend of ours, Mark Poynton. He's a Michelin-starred chef. Leo used to work for him a long time ago at Alimentum. So it's going to be a good one. It's quite a long one. I think it's the longest one so far. So enjoy and, last episode. Hello, Mark.
Good morning.
Thank you for coming on. I know you're a busy guy. I want to start at the beginning. I want to talk to you about all those years ago, your childhood. Yeah. Where did you grow up and where did kind of your love of food start and what were your kind of childhood foods? What do you remember kind of mostly about your childhood?
So I grew up in an awful little council estate called Verleigh in Chester, so northwest England. Horrible place. Nice place, as council estates were in the 80s, but horrible. But it was a good upbringing, nice community. You can leave your front door open, all that sort of crap that, you know, people talk about from yesteryear. All that stuff happened. Food memories, I don't really have that many because my mum was an awful cook. Like, she'd burn boiled peas and stuff. My dad was a great cook, but he worked 6 days a week, so we'd have a Sunday roast cooked by him.
Yeah.
Which was always lovely. Mm. Or you do a pan of scouse. And for those of you that don't know what scouse is, it's
basically... There we go. I was just about to say, enlighten us.
It's basically a stew, but the scouse is like everything. They steal everything and they took it to their own and called it scouse, basically. It's basically just a meat stew, usually lamb, with whatever vegetables you've got and that sort of stuff. Braised for hours and loads of brown sauce at the end.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, you need the brown sauce.
Yeah. That's great. It's actually similar. My dad worked away a lot when I was a kid, but he was a good cook. So I have similar, like, on a Sunday, my dad would do a roast, and it used to be banging. It used to be amazing. And even now, like, his roast is incredible. It's kind of one of the things I remember about being a kid is my dad's roast. It's quite interesting, isn't it? My mum would cook during the week. I can barely remember what she cooked.
Yeah.
But I can always remember, like, the roast on a Sunday that he would cook. At what age did you kind of think, do you know what? I quite like food. I wouldn't mind doing this as a job. Or did you kind of fall into it? Was it kind of like a...
Yeah, no, it was totally accidental, really. Was quite good at school until about the age of 14. Played football, mates, all that sort of stuff. Sort of fell out of love with school. Got a job in a little cafe selling ice cream and bacon sandwiches and stuff. And that was the first time I'd ever actually really cooked anything. It was bacon sandwiches and chips and, you know, that sort of crap. And it was, you know, it was good and I got money. I think it was like £2.50 an hour at the time. Okay, I don't get much more now. So had that job and then started a lifestyle of going out, as youngsters do. I was 14, 15, going out, drinking, 20-20 by the canal and stuff.
Brilliant,
like that.
Yeah.
And needed more money because obviously that's never enough money because, you know, as a child you always want more. So got a job in a hotel with my friend's mum. She was a head housekeeper and me and him started as waiters in this hotel, the Queen Hotel in Chester, which basically just supplemented
your drinking,
my drinking habits, and, you know, other extracurricular activities which were going on at the time.
Yeah.
I won't delve into that too much. Started there when I was 15, so 1995, and had a great time as a waiter. Got promoted to chef de rang, or serving wine and stuff, even before I was 18. Well, before I was 18, because when I turned 16, I wanted to change, and the chefs were starting work at 10 o'clock, finishing at 2 o'clock, going to the pub, coming back at 6 o'clock, finishing at 10 o'clock, and going to the pub. And I thought, what a fucking life.
Yeah.
That's what I wanted to do. I thought, if they can do it, I can do it. So,
it's like a vision. Ta-da!
Yeah. Yeah. So I became an apprentice chef in the kitchen purely for the lifestyle. I could go to the pub for 4 hours in the afternoon. Unbeknown to me, I think I was earning about £250 a week at the time as a waiter. Went down to £75 a week as an apprentice.
£250 a week's not bad, especially back then.
But I'd moved out of home at this point as well. So at the age of 16, I moved out of home because I had so much money. Sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? £250. I had so much money that I could afford to move out, so I did and moved out.
And then you're like, oh.
Yeah.
And you're working triple the amount of hours for, what did you say, £75 a week?
Yeah.
Wow.
£75 a week. But the chef, he had a lot of faith in me and he said, you're actually quite good at this, you should stick at it. sent me to college. I went to college for 3 days and thought, fuck this is rubbish.
What, like a catering college type thing?
Yeah, in Chester, and it was rubbish. I knew more than the rest of the chefs that had been there for 3 years.
Yeah.
I'd only been cooking for 6 months.
Yeah.
I had this amazing ability to absorb information from the other guys while having a laugh.
Yeah.
And so binned off college, and the chef said, right, because you haven't got your qualifications, you stay on £75 a week. So I did 2 years, £75 a week. And then he left, he moved to Macclesfield. And out of all the chefs, I was the first person he approached to go with him. He's like, oh, do you want to come to Macclesfield? It's right next to Manchester, you'll love it, you know.
So how far is that from Chester?
It's about 50 miles. It's not, okay. Not massive difference.
But enough, like a bit. It was definitely a bit of a move, a first move for you.
Yeah, I knew no one there at all apart from this chef. And I moved from the outskirts of Chester, which was like a 1 mile walk to the hotel, a 2 mile walk to the hotel, to a house about 2 minutes away. Mm. So I was still in the same vicinity, same friends and stuff. So I thought, yeah, Manchester, that's mega. You know, it's like the capital.
It was the 90s as well.
Yeah, the capital of the north.
Yeah.
Hacienda and all that sort of stuff. It was amazing. I did that. And that's when I first started to really get interested in food. Because at this point, I wasn't. It was like Manchester, drugs, drink, girls. Mm. You know, that's what I'm going to Manchester for. Fuck the work, that doesn't matter. You know, I'm going to be in the centre of all this craziness. And it was, to a certain degree. But there was another chef there called Remy Fougere, who was the group exec chef of the hotel group, whatever it was. And he used to have a Michelin star in France. Mm-hmm. So I got to work with him. And he sort of opened my eyes up to how food could be. But he left after 6 months, which was always the plan. So I bumbled around a little bit, cooking crap food for thousands of people. Like, I'm talking thousands of people. Mm. I used to do what was called the larder section.
Oh, I remember Leo starting out on larder.
So with the junior sous chef. So this hotel had 150 bedrooms, a golf club, a bar, a restaurant, and a spa. And there was me and the junior sous chef on this larder section. And on that, we had to do bar food, which opened from 12 till 11. We used to have to do the prep for the golf club. We had to do the restaurant food, which was lunch and dinner and conferences as well. So you'd do like sandwiches and stuff for the conferences. And then you had weddings. So you did all the starters for the weddings, plus all the buffets for the weddings. So like you could have like 15 things going off on a weekend between me and this one chef. And it was just like, it was chaos. Absolute chaos.
But good training.
Yeah, like you learn to be quick.
You have to get your head down and just crack on with it,
yeah.
You know. And so it's like, it does sound absolutely madness to me.
It was, and, you know, there was days we did, I think we did a rave, an all-night rave there, this company. It wasn't Ministry of Sound, but it was something like that at the time. They came over and took over the whole hotel and did a 24-hour party. So we had to set up, like, food stations all over the hotel for all these drunken drug addicts everywhere, and it was mental. Absolutely mental.
It does sound crazy.
Well, that's the sort of thing we did. It was the 90s, and, you know, you can't...
Anything goes.
Yeah. But this hotel was beautiful. Like, David and Victoria Beckham were there all the time. The United players were playing golf there. Like, football teams stayed there. It was, like, a big, posh hotel. And then there was all-night raves. It was just mental. But, yeah, it was good. So after 2.5 years, I think, the chef still wouldn't promote me. So I was getting paid a little bit more than the £75 a week, so obviously I'd moved. But he would not promote me for love nor money. He kept bringing in other chefs above me.
Why did he do that, do you think?
I think he wanted me to know everything before he would promote me.
So he wasn't doing it out of, like, spite or malice. He was just like...
Yeah, he was trying to help.
Yeah.
So I said, fuck it, I'm leaving. Applied for a job at the only Michelin star restaurant in Manchester at the time called Juniper. Went for the interview. I don't think I even told my head chef, to be honest. I went for the interview. Spent all day there, washing up, tasting food, eating sauces out of spoon, off pans and stuff like that. Got to the end of the day and the chef said, well, I'm going to be honest with you, you're not good enough to work here. But if we have a job vacancy in the future, you know, come back and we'll think about it. All right, no problem. I said, well, can I come back on my days off and help out? I said, yeah, no problem. So I've got every Tuesday off work, I think it was. And I went there and basically washed up every Tuesday for about 6 months.
For free?
Yeah, for free, just because I wanted to, you know, learn from what they were doing.
Be exposed to the environment, and you have to be a sponge, I suppose, and just soak it all up.
Yeah, and Juniper was a massively important restaurant at the time. Obviously, this is late 90s now, going into early 2000. But it was massively important, especially for the north of England. And, yeah, it was amazing. So I was absorbing all this stuff that was going on while not doing anything other than washing pots and pans, which was great. But the chef he employed instead of me walked out after 6 months. Couldn't hack it. So Paul phoned me up and said, do you want the job? It's yours. He said, you've shown dedication, you can have the job. I was like, yeah, all right, cool. This was in the November. He said, right, you can start in January when we reopen after our Christmas break. So I started there in January, how old was I? 99, I think. Either 99 or 2000, I can't remember. Fucking long time ago. 99, I think. Let's just say 99. And started on £6,000 a year. 6 days a week. 2 weeks holiday. Long ass hours. Long ass hours. Yeah, so £6,000 a week, even then, wasn't enough to pay tax.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
Yeah, it was just like...
It is, but it's, I mean, it's crazy. I know, like, kind of a joke about... I mean, we're the same age. We were just discussing previously. And my first job, not in hospitality, in a legal office, was £7,000 a year. Yeah. My first job. And I was like, this is it. Like, I was just thrilled. Yeah. And it's just like...
There's not a lot you can do with £550 a month, is there?
It was about that. It was about, I remember, it was about that amount. And I was living in, yeah, my rent was £140. £140? My rent was £140 a month.
Yeah.
So I was like, this is fine. I've got enough to do whatever. But I mean, it's yeah. I mean, and that's 9 to 5. Yeah. It wasn't doing, you'd have been working for...
Yeah, so we were...
20p an hour, or whatever you
were
working
for. Yeah, not even that, yeah. And it was 8 o'clock in the morning until sometimes I'd get home about 1 o'clock, because I was still living in Macclesfield. And Altrincham to Macclesfield is about 25 miles. So I used to get on the train in the morning. So I had to walk to the train station, which was a mile, get on two trains, get the train to Stockport from Macclesfield and then the train from Stockport to Altrincham. Or if I missed the Stockport train, I'd get the train to Manchester and then the tram from Manchester to Altrincham. And then another mile walk to work. But on the way home, the sous chef used to give me a lift to 3 miles from my house, because that's where he turned off to go home, and he had another 10 miles to drive. So he's like, I'm not going those 3 miles, you're going to have to walk. So... That's what I did.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, it was long hours, but it was good. Learned so much, and I still use recipes from there now, and even Sophie.
Would you say that was, like, your like you just said, you use recipes now, that was kind of a turning point for you?
Massively.
Going there and learning and having that opportunity is kind of, was like the springboard for everything else that kind of came after it.
Yeah, because I've never seen stuff like it either. For me to see a scallop, it came in a plastic box full of water, you know. I've seen live scallops, live langoustines, lobsters. Game was getting dropped off by the back door and all that sort. It was that sort of, like, you know, what you read about happens. It was exactly like that. It was mental. And the workload was mega as well. But it was so, that restaurant was so influential, not only for the chefs that worked there, but for other people. Like, Gordon Ramsay came to eat there when he had 2 stars because he'd heard about it. Ashley Palmer Watts come to eat there when we was there. It was this place where everybody ascended onto because the food was so forward thinking at the time. We were doing like 25 course taster menus in the 90s. But that's not the worst thing. The worst thing was the chef used to make it up in his head as he'd go along. So he'd get a check on the menu, would say 10 course, 20 course taster menu, whatever. That was it. It wouldn't be listed most of the time. So Paul's partner, Kate, used to come in the kitchen and check on 20 course taster menu. He'd be, right, okay, what we're going to do is this, followed by this, and you get 3 courses down, he wouldn't tell you anymore.
Do you know what though, even listening to you saying that is like giving me anxiety. So you were just on your toes all the time, waiting for the, I mean, he's either a maniac or a genius. It's like a bit of both.
he's definitely a bit of both. Yeah.
But that, even that, so you're working at a, you know, yeah, you're working at a level, kind of a really high intensity level, because you don't know what's going to come next, essentially.
No. Yeah, and it was four rosettes as well. One was a star, 4 rosettes, 8 out of 10 in a good food guide. It was, and so yeah, you get 3 courses down, he'd be like, right, next course I want, let's say for example, we'll do duck breast, braised duck leg, peas and sweet corn. You'd be right, he knows we've got the duck, it's in the fridge, but the legs have been prepped, but they're not been braised. So you'd have to braise the legs to order for like in 15 minutes time. You have to bone them out, get them in the oven and braise them, but you'd also have no peas and sweet corn. And you'd be like, chef, I haven't got any peas. So Sainsbury's is open. So you'd have to, middle of service, send the KP.
Run
around to Sainsbury's and get peas and shit. Like, fucking mental.
How long were you there for?
18 months.
18 months.
Yeah, I was exhausted by the end of it. You know, 2021, I think. I was exhausted by the end of it. And I wanted to see other stuff as well.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't afford to do anything, because I only had £500 a month, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So yeah, I wanted to see something, so I wrote to a few restaurants, got no response, saw Midsummer House advertised in the Caterer because everyone used the caterer back, the Hotel and Caterer magazine back then to find jobs. Mm. There wasn't really anything online back then. Mm. So yeah, applied for the job, went down for the interview. I had an amazing experience with Daniel that, you know, even though Paul had a massive influence on the way I cook, Daniel was the one that really taught me everything about food and how to taste. Get to the interview at 8 o'clock in the morning. Daniel's like, you're with me. And there was a French guy on garnish. And I can't remember his name because I only met him for half a day. But it's this French guy on garnish and he was getting absolutely bollocked by Daniel all day. So I'm doing prep, picking up prep for him while talking to Daniel about what we've done and all that sort of stuff. And get to the middle of lunch service and Daniel's like, right, all we need to do is get stuff out of the fridge for me. You know, get check on for veal kidneys, get them out of the fridge. So we do that. In the middle of lunch service, he's bollocking this guy in French because Daniel speaks quite good French because he worked there.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. And so he's speaking to him in French. Halfway through the service, as this boy's going down big time, turns to me and says, can you do his fucking job? I said, yeah, of course I can. He went, good. You got the job. I was like, what? He went, when can you start? I was like, well, month. He went, right, good, you're starting a month, you got his fucking job. And that was it.
Oh my God.
Didn't discuss money, nothing. It's like, you've got the fucking job.
And you were like, sweet.
Yeah. It's like, well, yeah.
I'm now going to move 300 miles.
Yeah, 300 miles to
Cambridge.
Yeah, from one maniac to another maniac.
So that was, yeah, early. That early was noughties,
early
like
noughties, yeah.
2001, whatever.
So that'd have been the end of, that'd have been end of 2001, maybe. Yeah, yeah. End of 2001.
Wow. And then you, so you just came down and that was that. It was your, yeah, kind of, that was your vocation then.
Yeah, that was it. That was, I knew for life that's what I was going to do. And, you know, everyone says, oh, I had these dreams that I was going to be this and I was going to do that and I was going to, you know, I can have a restaurant by the time I'm 30. I'm going to, you know,
yeah,
retire by it. I had none of those dreams at all. I just fell into this job by accident. Happened to be quite good at it.
Yeah. And it seemed like you had the right people kind of that you worked with them.
Yeah.
The right people, or even the case of Juniper, you were saying, you went set out once you kind of knew that I'm good at this and this, you know, you kind of then made a beeline for, well, this is the best place. This, yeah, is where I want to be. So kind of did your own path a little bit.
Yeah.
And was nurtured along the way by certain chefs, but kind of.
Yeah, and I was, but to be honest with you, I was only ever focused on me. In a selfish way, you know, yeah, people say, I want to go and work for Ramsay because it's amazing. You know, I can fucking want to go and work for him because, yeah, you become institutionalised. I didn't want to be that. I wanted to be me and, you know,
absorb and, yeah, take and then create yourself.
Yeah, and had, yeah, no ambitions to open a restaurant at any point or, you know, even create my own food. Just wanted to do it for me.
Yeah.
See how good I could be, I suppose. That was it. Yeah. And that's where it all started, you know, Juniper and then Midsummer House, really.
So you were at Midsummer House for how long?
8.5 years.
8.5 years. That's quite a long time in that kind of high intensity
life. Yeah, well, at the time, it was the longest I think anyone had been there because, as you probably know, being in the area, it's quite, yeah, an intense kitchen and they go through, not so much now, but back then, it was only one star back then as well. It went through a fuck ton of staff just because it was so intense.
Yeah.
And Daniel was still quite young. I don't even think, Daniel might have just been 30 at that point. No, he wasn't. How old was Daniel? I think Daniel was 26 or 27, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were all quite young in the kitchen. Mm. And Matt Gillen was there as well. He was a sous chef before he went to work for Ramsay and went on and did his own thing. It was, yeah, it was intense, man. Really intense, but mega.
And, yeah, and so from there you went to Alimentum, is that right?
Yeah, so 8.5 years at Midsummer House, achieved 2 stars, became head chef, all that sort of nonsense. Yeah. Got headhunted to go and work at the grill room in Dorchester.
Oh, right.
I had no ambition to leave Midsummer House at any point ever at this point because I was, you know, I was happy. And got headhunted for that. I told Daniel, and he's like, yeah, no, go for it. It's a mega opportunity. Go for it.
That's really cool.
He flipped on me, though.
Oh, okay, carry on.
And this is all in the book. So, you know, he's read the book, so he knows what's,
yeah,
in,
yeah,
it. So
yeah.
this is not a new thing. So, with his wishes, go for the interview. And there was 3 of us in line for the job. So I think I had 4 or 5 interviews for it. So I went down for an interview, then I had to go and see HR, and then I had to do a cook-off. I had to do a 5-course tasting menu for 6 or 7 people. Did that. At this point, Daniel's still really cool with me because it was all on a Tuesday or Wednesday when I was meant to be working. And he's like, yeah, no problem, go, it's fine. Didn't get the job, apparently because my food was too high level because they only ever wanted it to be like
a grill
so, brasserie, yeah, sort of thing. And yeah. I thought to myself, why are you headhunting me for the job then? So anyway, it doesn't matter. The £100,000 a year salary would have been nice. So yeah, no, I didn't get it, but then come back and told Daniel, and Daniel then all of a sudden came a bit frosty with me. He's like, so you want to leave? I was like, no, it was never the intention. He's like, yeah, but you've been for interviews. I'm like, yeah, but I didn't tell you I wanted to leave. I just told you what was going on. He went, well, I think you should leave. I'll look for a new head chef and we'll call this your notice. We won't give you any time period. We'll call this your notice. You should leave. It's like, right.
Wow. Okay.
So had various other interviews at places, and
how did you feel about that? Were you a bit hurt?
Yeah, a bit hurt. Yeah. But I thought, fuck it, you know.
Okay, let's go.
Yeah, it's fine. I can do. I've been your head chef for 4 years. I can do this shit.
Yeah.
Spoke to John Hudgel at Alimentum at the time, and originally turned him down without doing anything. I said, no, I'm not interested, because there was rumours that he wasn't making much money and he'd been through a couple of head chefs at the time, and you know, it was a restaurant stroke jazz bar stroke, you know, all things to all people. It wasn't really what I wanted to do. So I went for more interviews, couldn't get the job. And I think most of the reasons I couldn't get the job because the reputation we had at Midsummer House of being arseholes and going through loads of staff. And then John come back to me, he said, reconsider it, put this package together. He's like, do you want the job or not? And yeah, this had been pretty much a year by that point. I was like, do you know what? Yeah, I'll take it. So agreed to take the job. Went back and told Daniel, and he fucking lost it. Fucking lost it big time.
Well, I guess it's in Cambridge. It's, yeah, like, yeah. It's on the doorstep. I imagine he may have thought, oh, he'll go to London or he'll go to Leeds or whatever. Yeah. But this was literally like three miles up the road. So, yeah,
he wasn't far at all. Yeah. And he's like, lost the plot. Didn't speak to me for my final month. On my last day, after last main course, it might have been last starter, patted me on the back, said thank you very much, didn't even shake my hand and just walked out.
Oh, I think he was a bit hurt too, though.
Yeah, well, we still speak all the time. We spoke about it since, and he said it was the hardest thing was thinking that I'm still in Cambridge, and obviously it's going to be detrimental to Midsummer House and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And he's realised now that it wasn't.
No, but I guess at that point maybe his ego was feeling it a little bit and was like, oh, you know, it's going to be, because obviously I guess at that time there was literally no competition.
No, there was nothing.
So it was the first time, and it's someone you knew, and he knows your capabilities. So it's all a bit kind of sensitive, isn't it?
Yeah, it was very raw. We didn't speak for nearly a year after that then. So it was like nearly 2 years we hadn't spoke, a year working for him, and a year afterwards.
Oh.
It was a bit hard. I actually only spoke to him because he was doing a dinner for charity, for Red Nose Day or something, and he invited all his chef mates, like Paul Cunningham, 2 Michelin star, Sat Baines, 2 Michelin star, Claude Bosey, 2 Michelin star, Glyn Purnell, 1 Michelin star. And this time I'd just got 3 rosettes and I had 5 out of 10 in Good Food Guide, I think. And he phoned me up, he said, can you come and do the Tuesday night? I was like, what? Like, all these chefs, and you want me to do Tuesday? He went, yeah. So I went and did the Tuesday night dinner for him, and it was quite cool. Then we started speaking again.
That's really nice. Yeah, he thought so. It was like, just had to have a little bit of time.
Yeah. To get over himself.
Yeah. And then be like, actually, can you come and cook for me?
Yeah.
Amazing.
And so, and then we started speaking again. He was the first person that called me when I got a Michelin star.
So, so I wanted to mention this. So you were, how long were you at Alimentum when you got a star?
Started April 2009, got a Michelin star. I think it was September 2011 for the 2012 guide. I think I had it for 5 years, but I think that was it. I can't remember. It was all a bit hazy then.
Because I remember that was really exciting. It was really exciting.
Yeah, was Leo with me then?
No, he wasn't.
I can't remember.
He was there 2010.
Was he?
Yeah. We got married in 2000. No. No, he was there 2011, but he left end of 2011. So yeah. I think you got it the following, maybe 2012.
Must have been the following year.
Yeah, because he definitely, I don't think he was there when you had the star, no.
Yeah.
But it was really exciting.
It was amazing for Cambridge.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, for me and for the team. Not just for me, for the team.
So am I right in thinking you get the star? Is this my... This or is, the restaurant does? Like, what... So, I'm sorry if I'm being kind of...
No. The official line is, from Michelin...
Yeah.
The restaurant belongs to nobody, but it's awarded to the restaurant for the food they serve only. Only the food. So this nonsense you hear about service tablecloths and all that, it's complete and utter nonsense.
Oh, okay. Right.
You get a Michelin star for the food and for the food only. And it's awarded to the restaurant. On the flip side of that, Michelin now has an award where they invite the chef and give the chefs a jacket with a name on it that says Michelin star.
Mm.
So it's a bit, you know, I don't know. I'll always be known as a Michelin star chef. That's amazing. But
if Alimentum was, obviously it's closed since, you left and then it closed about 2 years later, didn't it?
A year, I think it was, yeah.
But if it was still open, would it still be classed as a mission? But do you see what I mean? It's like not. So it was kind of stayed with you, and then when you left.
So we'd already lost it before I left.
Oh, had you?
No, we lost it the year before I left.
Oh, okay.
Which was a kick in the bollocks.
Yeah. Were you like genuinely like, oh, like gutted?
Yes, but no. More upset because you can't speak to Michelin.
Yeah.
It's really difficult. Well, you can. You can phone them up and ask to speak to the editor or whoever. And I did speak to the editor about 6 months later. But you don't. There's no reasoning why. It's just they deem that you're good enough or you're not. And it's not... People say it's like the Oscars of the food world or whatever, or the Olympics. But it's not, because you can lose a Michelin star. Mm. And what other people don't realise is you don't get a star and keep a star. You're basically awarded it every single year because they can take it away at any point. Mm. And that's what they did. They obviously deemed that the food wasn't good enough. I thought at the time the food was better than it was 5 years prior when we got it. But they didn't. They didn't agree and took it away. So I was angry the fact that he wouldn't tell me why. And that's the overriding issue. But I've got massive respect for what they do. They're the most important food guide in the world. I don't care what anyone says. You know, it is massively important.
So would you say that was the proudest moment in your career, would be getting a Michelin star? I mean, it's pretty big. It's pretty big for a chef, you know, like any chef, but especially in that kind of fine dining arena, like a Michelin star's, surely that's what most people aspire to.
As I would have said so up until June last year.
Yeah.
I would have said definitely, yeah, it was, you know, it's whatever, you know, little kids that want to be a chef, it's what they dream of. Yeah. I was never that person, so I never dreamt of that. But yeah, it was amazing and it was a pinnacle. But there was other plus points as well. Because of that, obviously, I went on Great British Menu.
Yeah.
Got to cook in Singapore for a bank for 1,000 of their best customers. I've been to India, travelled because of it.
Yeah, I remember you've been to India.
But I would say now my proudest achievement is probably opening this up in the pandemic.
Yeah.
I imagine, and being able to open for 11 weeks. And then being recognised by Michelin again in only 11 weeks, it probably makes me prouder than before, to be honest.
Yeah, because there's been obviously a gap where you left Alimentum, were looking at different options, what you were going to do, and then obviously, we're actually in your restaurant in Fenditton. I'm saying it so that the people know where we are. I've eaten here twice now. Yeah. I had lunch. We had lunch for Leo's birthday, and we had a fantastic lunch. Yeah. I'll tell everyone how great it was. It was just great. We loved it. The food was so good. Front of house, it was just spot on. Everything was great. It's just brilliant. And it's nice to have somewhere not in town.
Yeah.
I know it sounds really boring and a bit... I mean, we live outside of Cambridge, so for us it's just nice to be able to go somewhere really nice that you don't have to, like, park, you know, all of that, like, nuisance in a way. It's just easy.
Yeah.
Lovely, really relaxed environment, and it's great. The both times I've been, I've had a lovely time, and we're planning to come back. It's so nice. So you opened in June, is that right?
Got the keys on June 1st.
June 1st, 2020. You got the keys.
Yeah.
And how long was that? Again, was that like a long process that you were like, "Are we going to get it? Are we not?" Like how?
So after I left Alimentum, which was actually pretty much June 1st, 2018.
Right, so two years.
Yeah. I started doing pop-ups, and the second place I did a pop-up was here. Obviously, at the time, it's called the Ancient Shepherds. Well, we've rebranded to MJP at the Shepherds, but, you know, the pub as it is since the 1860s, the Ancient Shepherds. I did a pop-up here, and it was so successful. I think, because at the time, it was more of a pub than what we've got now. I think we did about 55 people. When I say me on my own in a kitchen doing a choice menu for 55 people, and it was so successful that the landlord at the time said, why don't you come back on a regular basis, like on every Wednesday or every other Wednesday? So we did that, and it was oversubscribed every time, packed, which was amazing.
But the thing is, you get your followers, I say that, followers or fans, but there'll be people that have followed your career, especially in Cambridge, since you were at Midsummer House. And wherever you go, they're going to go because they want to eat your food. And I think that must be really lovely as well, that you know, like, you'll see the same face when you open up, like, arriving, because they know that your food's going to be good and they want to come and eat.
Well, I didn't think it was going to happen like that. And not because, obviously, I knew a lot of the guests, because of the supper clubs at Alimentum, where, you know, where I went out and talked to everybody.
Yeah.
So I knew a lot of them, but restaurants like that, you know, any of those sort of fine dining, whatever you want to call them, restaurants are quite faceless from a chef's point of view, because you're just, you're stuck in a kitchen, head down, and you just get on with what you do, and hopefully no plates come back and everyone's happy. So I was a bit surprised when actually the first pop-up I did sold out in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And then the same with the rest, they just kept selling out, and it was always the customers from Alimentum, and then word spread, and then it was new customers.
Yeah.
And then when I came here for the pop-ups here, it was customers from Fenditton that I'd never met before.
Yeah.
And now they're still coming back 2 years later, which is there's one guy who lives in the village. I won't say his name because I'm not sure he wants me to, but he's booked in 13 times in the first 6 weeks that we open.
Oh my days.
Yes, from Thursday. So he's opened, booked in 3 times this week when we open on Thursday.
Wow.
Yeah, and he just loves it.
That's brilliant. Yeah.
And it's just built, this thing's built massively.
Yeah.
And before we got locked down last time in November, so we've been open for 11 weeks, opened in August, managed to open for 11 weeks, and then we went into national lockdown again in November, and then we didn't reopen again in December because it wasn't worth it. In those 11 weeks, we were fully booked every service, lunch and dinner, and we were fully booked for the whole of November and December before we got locked down.
It's brilliant. And you've only been open since June?
Yeah. No, it's only been open since August.
Since August, of course. Yeah.
Because this was a bit spit and sawdust, wasn't it? It wasn't the nicest pub in the world.
No, I mean, yeah, I've been in here when it was very much a locals pub, wasn't it? Like, just, yeah, like you say, tiles, and it was fine.
Yeah.
Very dark. Yeah. Very dark, and, you know, again, that's something that you come in here now, it's so bright, makes such a difference, just putting a bit of white on the walls.
Yeah, and some nice music. And
well, that was one thing I noticed when I came. These tunes just banging out of the kitchen, predominantly 90s. I feel like it was like Northern, like Manchester vibes. Like, that's kind of what it was. A bit of Oasis, a bit of like the Charlatans, like all of that kind of stuff. Which, again, I personally like. It's not that you're getting really, obviously, you're eating really high quality food with high quality ingredients, cooked amazingly, but it's not stuffy.
Yeah. And you're not listening to Jamie Cullum or Katie Mellower, you know?
No, like, and there's no tinkling of the ivories, which, you know, is fine if you're at afternoon tea at the Ritz, but not, you know, when you're... Yeah. That's, I think that's kind of something that kind of sets it apart and makes it feel a bit more modern and a bit more, just kind of casual place, even though, like I said, you're eating really delicious food.
And it's meant to relax you, because the music is obviously my playlist, because there's a speaker right by the kitchen, and, you know, without being selfish, I want to listen to my music. I don't want to listen to, you know, crap I'm not interested in. But it's also quite relaxing. Obviously, there's a few swear words in some of the songs, but I think the majority of people don't mind, because if you come to a restaurant to enjoy yourself, you're chatting anyway. And if you're enjoying yourself, the music is secondary.
It is.
It's only if you're in an awkward sort of, like, you know,
date situation.
Yeah, or you argue, come out with your husband or wife, and you're arguing and you don't talk to each other, that you listen to the music. But everyone knows 90s music.
Yeah, or the people that are going to come, kind of your demographic as well, who you know that are going to come, will do. But I also think it just gives that bit of personality.
Yeah.
Like you said, it's just a bit vague if you have the same type of thing, and it just injects just a little bit more into the experience, I think.
It's quite an eclectic playlist. It goes from Oasis, like you said, Charlatan, Stone Roses, so obviously all 90s. Then there's Tupac on there. And then there's also Sam Fender on there as well. So it's like, it's very now and then, hip hop and indie and pop. And
I think that's quite unusual though.
Yeah.
As in, like, for like a restaurant of this type, shall we say, to actually have that kind of music being played.
But it's cool though, isn't it?
I love it. It's right up my street. Yeah.
I think more people should do it.
I love it. Great. But you were also doing as well, collection and delivery.
Yeah. So we stopped that last week for the time being, because obviously we need to concentrate on reopening again. But that was mega. We had been doing that for, I think, 54 weeks when we stopped.
Wow.
Which was mental.
Yeah.
Hate putting food in plastic boxes.
Yeah.
It's a horrible feeling, especially when you've worked in a place of work. But wouldn't have been able to open the restaurant without it, because I started before we took over the Shepherd's, and certainly wouldn't be open now if we hadn't done it.
Yeah.
And we would, you know, it's not everything's about money, but there was weeks I was selling.
But it helps when you've got a new restaurant that you can't open. Yeah. especially, you know, last year, there was a big question mark when no one knew what was going to happen. Yeah. All these things help, don't
they? And the government weren't always forthcoming with giving the money, or certainly the local governments. You know, the grants that were meant to be given out weren't always that easy to get hold of.
You've got to do what you've got to do.
If you're going to get them, yeah. And you know, but there was weeks we were taking a lot of money on the takeaway food, like £4,000 a week, which was at the time is
that's crazy.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
But so, £18 for three courses of microwave food, that's a lot of plastic boxes.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's good. And the business model's there to continue it. And I'm going to email all the customers that had it after we reopen and see if they're still interested, and if they are, going to carry on doing it. If they're not, then we'll stop, obviously.
Because I know Leo's parents had the roast.
Yeah, they had roast a few times, and fish and chips
and
on a Friday.
And fish and chips, yeah, as well. And it's just nice. It's just a nice thing to be able to do, I think. Yeah. People who just don't necessarily want to come out.
Yeah.
But I think there's lots of different models that have popped up in the last year because of the pandemic. Yeah. Like one of the local ones that I use all the time now is Click It Local.
Ooh.
And it's just so great being able to be outside of Cambridge and be able to get stuff delivered to your door that I wouldn't be able to get. And it's the same sort of thing. It's so convenient.
Yeah.
And now I just think, I can't see people going back to that. I still think there's a convenience side of it that people are going to enjoy, which wouldn't have happened if the pandemic hadn't hit. There's all these different positives.
And that's the thing. And it's, you know, and obviously there's two aspects of it. There's people that did the cook at home food, like Restaurant 22, where you have to build the meal yourself and stuff. Or there's what we did dumbed down microwave food, basically, which was really good in its own right. But, you know, it was, you know, we did casseroles and stuff like that, which was amazing. But it's giving the people the ability to have whatever they want on a given day, because in our home life, we've all become quite lazy, haven't we? We don't
definitely.
Cooking.
I don't. I mean, I've got no interest in it in any way. I actually find cooking quite stressful because I don't really enjoy it.
Yeah.
Which is why I married a chef, because he enjoys it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the balance, isn't it? So, but there must be other people that are in a couple or have a family where both people don't want to bother with the cooking. Yeah. You know, they just and that's what you want. You want the ease. You want just, do you know what, that night I can just have this and put it in the microwave and it's going to be great. And I guess the good thing about your stuff as well, it's all cooked fresh. You know, there's no rubbish in it. There's no crap in
it. Yeah, of course.
Preservatives. So if you're going to have one of those naughty microwave meal, I say that microwave meals. Your meals are not microwave meals. Let's face it. But if you're going to get it from there, because you know it's going to be all good, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's cheaper than a generic high street chain restaurant. You know that.
Definitely.
We're doing that stuff as well.
So you've got coming out in autumn, fingers crossed, a book. So tell us a bit about that. Is it a cookbook? Is it a memoir? Is it a mixture of the two? So what can we expect from it?
So there's obviously bit of a story but what we talked about today, and a bit more in depth about Midsummer House, because that was obviously a massive part of my life. There's recipes, 70 recipes, some restaurant recipes, some old Alimentum recipes, signature dishes, like the Battenberg and stuff like that.
Love which that which love that so much.
And then there's some of that at home dishes as well,
because
I thought, you know, we've been doing it for so long that people might actually want to know how to make the sticky toffee pudding that we make and all that sort of stuff. So there's that. Some of the local suppliers like Mill Road Butcher. It's quite
so
a cool book.
It's going to be quite an all-rounded book then.
Yeah.
So there'll be recipes in there for people that really want to get stuck in the kitchen and do the basting, and I don't even know the words that you would use.
Yeah.
And then you've also got just good home-cooked stuff, like if you want to make a good sticky toffee, that's in there too.
Yeah, and there's lamb casserole in there, there's beef jalfrezi in there. And it will be a book for lots of people, and there's vegetarian, vegan recipes, there's just fish recipes, so it's quite flexible.
Nice, and that's going to be autumn.
Fingers crossed October,
October.
It's going to be called It's Just Food.
It's Just Food, I like that.
Yeah, because it is just food.
It is just food, yeah, that's right. I like that, it's really simple. That's really exciting.
Yeah.
Are you excited about that?
I am excited. It was nervous, it's not an easy thing to do. Even though I said before, I was quite academic in school, I was. But I'm not anymore.
That was 25 years ago.
Yeah, it was 25 years ago. Thanks, Charlie. But trying to write 70 recipes in layman's terms is quite difficult.
Yeah.
Because I've always been good. I've always had all my recipes written down or typed up. But it's just like, you know, my crab sauce recipe is written down in less than 200 words.
Mm.
But to actually write that so everybody understands is nearly 1,000 words. So that's quite difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, because again, you're talking to people like me that who are going to be like, what is this? I don't, you know.
Yeah, because normally it would just say crab, carrots, onions, garlic, blah, 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 blah,
and
blah,
blah.
Just
go bish, bash, bash, yeah, and it's done.
Yeah, but then I have to explain to people, you know, you have to cook your crab, take everything out, smash your crab up, roast your bones, cut your vegetables to a certain size, roast your vegetables, drain them off, add this, add that, add this.
Was it a nice process? Did you like revisit some old dishes that you were like, oh yeah, that was, I really like that dish, or things like that? So kind of, it was a bit nostalgic for you.
Yeah, and also, because it was in lockdown as well, I got the chance to create some new dishes at the same time as well, which are in the book, which will be on the menu when we reopen.
Oh, nice.
So it was like, give me a chance to play, but also reminisce at the same time.
Yeah, I like that.
But also Paul Kitchen and Daniel Clifford also see massive influences from them in it.
Yeah.
Like all the puree recipes were from Paul Kitchen. All the sauce recipes were stuff we did with Daniel, and, you know, so it's like...
That's nice. Yeah. It's like a kind of a melting pot of a kind of your career, basically.
Yeah, and Daniel wrote the foreword as well, so that's quite nice.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, so it's a good job we talk again, isn't
it? Yeah, it is, yeah. Right, we're going to wrap things up now. So I've got final question for you, which is, it's about the burgers. Come, this is why we're here.
Yeah.
This is what everyone wants to know. So I want to know, what's the best burger you've ever had? Where you ate it, country, restaurant, wherever, who you're with, if you want to divulge that information, and most importantly, what was in it? What was actually in the best burger you've ever had?
So there's two, if I'm allowed. My kids would want me to say McDonald's, but I'm not going to.
Our kids would probably say McDonald's as well, yeah.
Well, no, Ray would say Steak and Honour. Molly would say McDonald's. But, no, so two. I'll go with the one that I had first, which I thought was the best, other than Steak and Honour, of course, because we can't... You told me I'm not allowed to say Steak and Honour.
You're not, yeah.
So the first one was, I think it was about 2012, was at Barbaloud in London.
Okay.
And there was a chef there cooking called Dean Yasharin, who was a chef de partie at Midsummer House, and went to work for Gordon Ramsay in New York and Daniel Baloud in New York, and then opened Daniel Baloud's restaurant at the Mandarin Oriental in London, and they had this burger, and it was an ultimate luxury burger. It was, I think it was like 65% chuck, which had been ground.
Mm.
There was foie gras, which had been minced into it, and bone marrow, which had been minced into it.
Whoa, okay.
So, and it was delicious.
Rich.
Rich, lovely cheese topping, nice sesame seed bun.
Yeah.
Lovely crisp lettuce and amazing crinkle cut fries, I think, if I remember.
Yeah.
It was good. But that was part of like a 7-course meal I had with a wine supplier there.
Nice.
So I didn't pay for it either, which made it nice.
Yeah, it makes it even better.
And we were drinking magnums of like Petrus and stuff as well, because it was like a wine lunch tasting thing. And
just
it was,
bring it on.
Yeah. So
you think it was the best burger, one of the best burgers you've had, but it's a hazy memory.
Yeah, and it was, and the whole thing, and I think it was just the fact of drinking amazing wine, having lots of food.
Yeah, but that's what it is sometimes, right? Yeah. It's not, and we were talking about food, but it's just food, as you were saying in your book. Sometimes it's about the whole experience.
Yeah.
And it's not always like, yeah, it was really great, but you know what? It was a great day, and the person I was with was brilliant, and we had this, and it becomes an experience rather than just a one-off, isn't it? What was the second one?
So the second one is from my beef supplier in Northern Ireland. I went to see him a few years ago. A load of chefs went over on a visit to Northern Ireland, because Belfast in particular was the cultural city of Europe or some crap like that at the time. And we got taken over, paid for by Visit Britain to go and see some suppliers, and met Peter Hannon for the first time, who supplies all my beef now at the restaurant. And he's famous for his beef, obviously. It's single cattle from one farm, Glen Arm Estate in Northern Ireland. And he was the first person in the UK, I'm not sure if Europe, that started salt aging meat in Himalayan salt chambers.
Okay.
So he started that, and he's got two massive walk-in rooms, probably the size of the shepherds.
What, so they just literally hang, and then so salt them and then hang them?
No, don't salt them. So the room is just full of blocks of Himalayan salt at the right temperature.
Okay.
So it's just like an orange room.
Yeah.
And the beef gets wheeled in for however many days, and then they use that beef.
It just like absorbs essentially into it. Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it dry ages in there. Last time I went, he'd had a whole sirloin in there that had been dry aging for over a year. And it was amazing, because he's just trying to do different stuff with this stuff, and it is amazing.
Wow.
So he's got a production kitchen there. I've been to see him twice, I think, or three times. And we cooked up a load of his meat. Andrew Nutter was there. I think Eric Snay from Titchwell Manor might have been there. There was loads of us there. And so we had like Cote de Boeuf, we had sirloins, we had fillets, we had everything you can imagine. And he cooked some burgers. So it was, it's a free meat or a free muscle mix.
Yeah.
He doesn't really tell you what's in it, but I think there's tri-tip in it, some rump in it, and I think there's chuck in it. And it's just pure minced beef.
Yeah.
But because it's his beef and it's from his salt aged beef, yeah, it's just insane. I ate it on its own, no bun, no nothing.
Literally just a patty.
A patty.
Yeah.
Cooked all
any
the way through.
Salt on it?
No, just cooked all the way through.
So not even pink?
Not even pink.
Just, oh, okay.
Yeah, and it was just so delicious and juicy.
Yeah.
And it was just amazing.
It sounds it.
Just pure beef.
Yeah.
And it's not, obviously it's like you guys do burgers, it's not pressed into a patty or anything, it's just
no,
a ball of beef and then squashed onto the plancha.
But I think now, isn't it trendy to be have like smash patties where you really flatten them?
Yeah.
Ours aren't quite that, they're still a bit of...
No, you want them to be thick because you want them to hold the juice a little bit and that juice to come out into your bun, which makes it, you know, steam it and all that.
Yeah.
So I don't need to tell you how to cook a burger.
You might need to tell me, to be honest, but yeah.
But yeah, that was it.
So I love that.
Peter Hannon's.
So it's kind of two extremes in a way. Rosie's were similar. She had two extremes as well. And it's really interesting. Speaking to chefs when they have... Yeah. It's like the sublime to the ridiculous in a way. You have these...
Yeah.
The mandolin oriental, you say?
Yeah, yeah.
And then you have a farm...
Yeah.
And both, you know, equally as good, both memorable.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, great.
Yeah.
Brilliant. That's well, thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for talking to me. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
I will see you again soon. So that's it. Series one is done. Huge, huge thanks to Rosie, Neil, Pina, Becca, Deepa and Mark for taking the time to chat to me. I really appreciate it. I hope you've enjoyed it. I really enjoyed recording it. I'm going to be recording series two in the autumn, so I really hope you'll join me then for more Burger Bants. In the meantime, please support and follow all of the guests that we've had on. I will see you very soon. Take care and see you soon for series two.